Chapter 19, The Commonwealth of Israel. Would someone like to read the first paragraph there, which is a quotation?
Oh, this one. Under the pseudonym Christopher North, writer John Wilson composed a series of articles for a long-running column called, oh my, that's what it says, 1822-35, for Blackwood's Magazine. The column provided social commentary in the form of discussions at an Edinburgh pub and Rose's Tavern. In one particular article, Wilson, as North, writes, "His Majesty's domain, on which the sun never sets, changed to the more user-friendly, the sun never sets on the British Empire, the phrase has endured as the most popular to describe the extent of British colonial lands holding during the age of imperialism until its fall following the Second World War. However, at its height in the 1930s, the British Empire spanned nearly a third of the world's land, including properties in Asia, Latin America, the Middle East, Australia, and Africa."
The sun never sets on the British Empire. A statement of hubris, basically. But one that seemed to be true for a long period of time. And it's talking about a third of the world's land. Well, the British Empire was primarily a sea empire. The land wasn't even the most important part of it. So, the empire was very significant. Why does this begin the chapter on the Commonwealth of Israel?
The word Commonwealth.
Yeah, Commonwealth. Well, the empire becomes a Commonwealth.
The British...
Sets up the difference. What's a Commonwealth and what's an empire?
Right. What is the difference between a Commonwealth and an empire? What's the difference between the British Empire and the British Commonwealth?
An empire is...
Citizenship is a big part. Compared to citizenship.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. A Commonwealth... an empire is controlled by the one place, and a Commonwealth is... they have rights.
Okay. And in fact, one of the definitions of Commonwealth is... or one of the older meanings is the same as common weal. In other words, the common welfare.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's for mutual benefit. It's a free association, or at least somewhat free association, of nations for mutual benefit. An empire is not that. Mm-hmm. It's one nation dominating the others and seeking to gain as much territory and power as possible for its own benefit, not for mutual benefit of all of the countries. So we can see this partly in the difference, in the historical difference between the British Empire and the British Commonwealth. And I think the reason the chapter begins this way is because that's the principal example that we have of a Commonwealth. I mean, there are other Commonwealths as well, you know, the Commonwealth of Virginia and so forth. But the political example that most people are most familiar with or could relate to in some way that helps to understand the Bible is the British Commonwealth. So... What are some of the characteristics of a commonwealth? Aside from the fact that people have rights, which they don't necessarily have in an empire if they're in the colonies. I mean, well, let's just spell that out. How is an empire divided? What are the basic units of an empire?
Colonies.
Well, there's the home country, and then there are the colonies.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly. There's a very strict hierarchy of control. So prior to the American Revolution, it was the American colonies of the British Crown, or what have you.
But in a commonwealth, each jurisdiction has its own government.
Mm-hmm.
It's not subject to one overseer or one overlord.
Right. In a commonwealth, it's different. You have essentially independent countries that are joined together in some way. Right. Now, how independence is spelled out formally may vary, but essentially each place rules itself. And they voluntarily joined in. And then some of the differences are spelled out here. In an empire, one nation rules all the others. In a commonwealth, each nation is self-governing. In an empire, differences pose a threat to unity. So they have to be squashed, in other words. That's the way empires usually look at it. Think about the Roman Empire and the Jewish Wars and so forth, even though the Roman Empire allowed some differences. In a commonwealth, differences are a source of enrichment. In an empire, full legal rights belong only to an elite. In a commonwealth, full legal rights are the heritage of all.
There was that double-edged sword.
Yes, it's a responsibility as well. Mm-hmm. But it's better to have rights and responsibilities than no rights and no responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. In the British Commonwealth of Nations, every citizen was entitled to a British education, a British passport, and British justice. A Kikuyu in Kenya and a Quebecois in Canada had as much claim to British citizenship as any lord in London. They were fellow citizens, fellow partakers, fellow members, and fellow heirs. And I think if in England they could vote in the British or in the English political system and so forth, they could participate in politics, things like that. Mm-hmm. That's a radical difference from the setup of an empire where you have actual texts from the imperial period saying that, you know, it's fine to kill as many colonials as you need to in Africa or what have you. They're not considered equal and they don't have rights. So in a commonwealth, each individual does have rights. So what makes it then the Commonwealth of Britain, the British Commonwealth, instead of just a generic commonwealth in which all nations participate in exactly the same way? Why shouldn't Australia or Canada, why shouldn't it be called the Canadian Commonwealth, for example?
It started with Britain.
Yeah, the people came out of Britain,
yeah,
out of the British Empire,
and structure, yeah,
and then chose to be a part of the Commonwealth.
Constitution of that Commonwealth.
Mm-hmm.
Now Britain,
right?
They introduced herself.
Well, not a constitution. You know what I mean? Yeah. Wrote it up.
The idea of political rights and responsibilities and freedoms as defined in the Commonwealth comes from Britain. Mm-hmm. It's not only historical, but as Fred is pointing out, it's all of the ideas, right, and the practices and the institutions as well. So there is a special place to Britain in the for Britain in the Commonwealth, and to deny that would be silly. Britain is the mother country, and in a sense, it's still the chief, even though these other nations have an inheritance in it and have a role in it. They also have rights in it. The Queen is still technically the head of state of Canada. Mm-hmm. Even though Canada is an independent country. And the head of state is, I think it's called the Governor General, is, you know, the Queen's representative in Canada. So there is still a special place for that nation and that place where the ideas came from, the foundations came from.
Does that mean? I was just thinking, so I wonder if she's the head of New Zealand.
The Queen?
Queen of England.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's how he knows.
She's part of the Commonwealth.
God save the Queen.
Mm-hmm. You had New Zealanders and Australians fighting World War II.
Yeah.
There's your responsibilities. They must be written down someplace, like a permanent alliance or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know a lot of the technical details of the British Commonwealth, but I think it's relevant for understanding the Bible because in one verse, there's a scripture that talks about Gentiles being brought into the Commonwealth of Israel, or the Politeia of Israel, which is like the political entity, the body politic. The Commonwealth is the usual translation. So what is a Commonwealth then, if this is a political term that's used in the scriptures to describe what God is doing? Here's one definition from dictionary.com. A Commonwealth is a group of sovereign states and their dependencies associated by their own choice and linked with common objectives and interests.
And common enemies, too.
Can be, yeah.
And that's what happened in the 20th century and the 19th century. They all started having a common enemy, and this helped them band together.
Mm-hmm.
And we as believers have a common enemy, the devil.
Okay.
In the way he works.
Okay, yep. Notice the specific elements of this definition, though. A group of sovereign states. Mm-hmm. So it's entities that have their own freedom to choose. Mm-hmm. It's nothing that's being imposed. Sovereign states have the right to choose. They have the right to make decisions and to defend their borders and to defend their interests and so forth. So a group of sovereign states and their dependencies associated by their own choice and linked with common objectives and interests. So a commonwealth, it's not enough to have an association of states for it to be a commonwealth. A commonwealth has to be a voluntary association of states or perhaps individuals, people, in the case of, say, the Virginia Commonwealth.
Or counties
or what have you, right? Some entity that has the right to choose and has chosen to enter into this agreement. And for what reason would people enter into such an arrangement?
Protection, trade.
Okay, there could be many specific reasons, mm-hmm. but just following along with this definition, linked with common objectives and interests. So they view their objectives, their goals, and their interests as being linked. They have common objectives, and hence the idea of the common welfare, the mutual benefit aspect of the Commonwealth. Mm-hmm. This is definitely a significant difference from the empire. How do you think this applies to the Commonwealth of Israel?
It describes its characteristics.
Okay. At least as well as any political analogy from modern times can.
Mm-hmm.
If we wanted to describe its characteristics by looking at some passages in Scripture, one place would be Isaiah 60. Arise, shine, for your light has come, speaking to Israel. And the glory of the Lord is risen upon you. For behold, darkness will cover the earth and thick darkness over the peoples. But upon you the Lord will arise and his glory will be seen upon you. Nations will come to your light. Goyim. And kings to the brightness of your rising. Lift up your eyes and look about you. All assemble and come to you. Your sons from afar and your daughters are carried on the arm. Your sun will never set again. Your moon will wane no more. The Lord will be your everlasting light and your days of sorrow will end. Many prophecies speak of nations coming to Jerusalem, coming to Israel, coming to the light that is there.
Mm-hmm.
They're making a choice. They're coming voluntarily because they see something and they want to come there. And it's for their blessing that they're coming to Israel when God rebuilds Israel and causes Israel's sun to set no more. So there is perhaps the analogy of the British Commonwealth is helpful in some respect with regard to that. Is there anything else that we could point to, perhaps?
Well, you're talking about having a motherland, and isn't the person that, if we believe it, Zion is the motherland. I mean, we don't say we want to go to Paris, or we don't say we want to go to Cleveland. It's Jerusalem. I mean, even as Gentile. And but at the same time, we as believers around the world have equal access to God, equal value to God.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, that's like citizenship, that we all have access to that.
Okay, can you point to some scriptures that talk about that?
Okay.
I mean, I think what you're saying is true, but how do we know that it's true? Do the scriptures suggest this in some way, or are we just fans of the British Commonwealth and we want it to be that way? Well, the first verse that we have to read is in Ephesians 2, where Gentiles are specifically addressed, and it's very clear in verse 11. Remember that you, being Gentiles in the flesh, called uncircumcision by that which is called circumcision in the flesh made by hands. And remember, this is the passage where there's a controversy over how to interpret at that time or formerly. Were they formerly Gentiles, or were they, or are they still Gentiles? But it's saying that these are people who are Gentiles and are called uncircumcision by those who are circumcised. Verse 12, at that time you were without Messiah, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. Let's just stop right there, because this is an important passage that certainly is neglected in traditional Christian understanding of the good news. Here is a clear biblical presentation of the state of Gentiles absent from the Commonwealth of Israel, when they're excluded from the Commonwealth of Israel. They're without Messiah, aliens from the Commonwealth of Israel, strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope, and without God in the world. So these are things that come from entering into that arrangement that God has provided in the new covenant, which is made with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. You can't have these things without entering into that arrangement. You can't have hope. You can't have God. You can't have Messiah. You can't have the covenants of promise without entering into the Commonwealth of Israel. And then in verse 13, but now in Messiah Yeshua, you who were formerly far off are made near by the blood of Messiah. And it goes on, and I can keep reading in a minute perhaps, but he's saying that the sacrifice of Messiah enables Gentiles to enter in to this commonwealth and therefore to participate in the rights of the commonwealth. Just as the British Commonwealth has certain rights, the Israeli Commonwealth has certain rights. Among those rights are Messiah, the covenants of promise, hope, and God. Some fairly important rights. More important than any rights that the Queen can bestow. So this is why the analogy of the Commonwealth is so important, because it's a central concept for understanding Gentiles and how they can enter into God's grace, how they can have a relationship with Messiah, how they can have any hope whatsoever, and any participation in God's covenants. They enter into this voluntary, mutually beneficial arrangement, which is described by the political term of a commonwealth. The passage in Ephesians goes on, for he is our peace, that referring to Messiah, who has made both one and has broken down the middle wall of partition. What is being referred to here?
The division between Jew and Gentile.
How did that division arise?
God separated the Jews, called them his own, gave them a law.
Right, it arose by God's command. God repeatedly commanded Israel to be separate from the Goyim. Right, but not only that, but he specifically commanded them to be separate from the Goyim. Mm-hmm. Commanded Israel to keep itself separate, not to intermingle with the Goyim in various ways.
Who are their kings over them?
Right, not to intermarry with certain peoples, right? Not to follow their practices, and so forth, and to keep his statutes. So the middle wall of partition, as it's explained in the following verse, is actually contained in the Law of Commandments. It was God's commandments that initially pronounced this separation of the Jews from the rest of the nations, from the Goyim. Yes.
Kind of fact, but I mean, some stuff on the Hasidic, and you know, the very basically, if they reach out to anybody, it's you know, just know the Jews, they don't care about the Gentiles, and you know, basically, you know, they have, let's say, we have our own God or whatever. But it, you know, it seems, you know, how can you, that's the whole thing about being in the world but not of the world, but they don't seem to be doing that, they, you know, so as I'm trying to find out what the biblical Jewish idea is. How can you be the light of the world, you know, to the world, and yet keep yourself separate from the world? And then,
mm-hmm.
And you are supposed to answer for every single rabbinical Jew that's ever lived. Don't you like that?
Well, but, I mean, again, there are many different perspectives among rabbinical Jews. The prophecy in Isaiah that talks about being a light unto the Goyim, okay. I think in its context refers first of all to the Messiah. Okay. Secondarily to all of Israel, in as much as Israel shares in the calling of Messiah. So that's the first answer, that is primarily Messiah. The second answer I would say is that it is possible to be a light to the nations in separation, and in fact that's part of what God commanded. Israel was to be a light by being separate, by not participating in what all of the nations did, by being different. And that in itself made it a light. Just as light is separate from darkness, that made it separate. So that's a partial answer to your question. I would just add to that, though, that certainly within the rabbinic Jewish tradition as well, you can find plenty of people who believe in tikkun olam, the restoration of the world as a whole, and are interested in reconciliation between Jews and Gentiles and look forward to the day when Jews and Gentiles can be together, as is prophesied, and things like that. In Talmudic writings, you can find, you know, things, statements talking about that part of the law changing in the Messianic age and so forth because of these prophecies that they recognize of the Gentiles coming to the Lord. So there are a lot of different ways that could be answered. I think maybe because time is short, we should stick, though, to the issue of the Commonwealth. Does someone else want to contribute something about this Commonwealth, maybe a scripture that relates to it, or how you understand this statement from God, which is important for Israel, but even more important for the Gentiles? So for any Gentile who believes, and by the way, there are more Gentiles in the world than there are Jews. So for any Gentile, this is a central statement, extremely important to your identity.
Well, what brought about the British Commonwealth was a British presence in those parts of the world, and the new ideas of modernization and democracy, and you know, that the world had come to, you know, that was ignorant, and when they were present in these countries, it brought a revolution of ideas and hospitals and, you know, all sorts of things that they all needed. Mm-hmm. Now, to bring it back to our case, the Jews are present in every single land in the world in this in the last few centuries, and even before that. Our influence has reached them. There isn't hardly any Gentile that doesn't know what a Jew is.
I don't know if that's true.
Well, they're in every country, let's put it that way. And God willing, you know, with the Messianic beliefs, God has a way to make us appealing to the Gentiles, whereas without Messiah, we repel the Gentiles. Just as in the British Commonwealth, the Brits repelled, you know, the people where they were at. India isn't part of the Commonwealth, is it? Israel, no, is it? No, no, and Israel wasn't part of the Commonwealth either, although Palestine was, you know, they wanted it to be part of the Commonwealth, but they wouldn't have it. Yeah, so good influence through the Messiah, through Jews that, you know, are spread throughout the world, you know, that'll bring forth the Commonwealth of God.
But keep in mind, though, that it's not necessarily the case that people are repelled by things that are wrong and attracted by things that are good. In fact, in the scriptures, it's usually the opposite. And Messiah is described as the servant who is rejected by all. A man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and his people is described the same way, and the suffering of the Jewish people is related to the suffering of Messiah in all the places where they've been, because God said he would put his name on them. And if you look at the suffering of the Jews, especially in Christian Europe, for example, they suffered because of their association with his name and their association with his scriptures, and how galling that was to the people who sought to usurp that calling for themselves. So, even in unbelief, I think the scriptures teach that Israel carries God's name and fulfills its calling to some extent in some way. I mentioned before about Israel being an example in Tanakh, sometimes for good and sometimes for not so good. Let's put it that way. That Israel does fulfill its calling one way or another, because its calling does not depend on itself. It does not depend on Israel's merit. It never has. It depends on God's choice. And that's what he said in the scriptures, that I chose you, to paraphrase, for my purposes. I didn't choose you because you were the best or the smartest or the most numerous, but the opposite. So the calling of Israel remains, and people among the Gentiles are repelled or attracted to it because of things in them and how they relate to the God of Israel, very often, regardless of whether Israel recognizes the Messiah or not. There's the saying that if God lived on earth, people would break his windows. Well, people have had the chance to show what they would do if God lived on earth, and essentially that's what they've tried to do, and worse, to his people, to his son, and so forth. So, we shouldn't expect that drawing closer to God will make the Jews or anyone else more appealing to the world. Sometimes it's the opposite. But it will make them more in line with God's calling. So I just wanted to add that qualification to what you were saying. Anything else on the whole idea of the Commonwealth?
I think it's important that you, when God told Abraham that he would make him a father of many nations, that mm-hmm. The blessings to the Gentile nations would come through him.
Right. Okay.
Revelation says God will have from every nation, every tribe, his people. Mm-hmm. So that the Commonwealth is reinstated and we're assured of the Commonwealth of every nation coming to him.
Mm-hmm.
I was just mentioning it to say how it's going to be brought about, because there is a presence in every nation.
Okay, right. But notice it is the Commonwealth of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that there's some new association that includes all these different peoples. God has established Israel as a commonwealth, as a political entity, from centuries ago, from millennia ago. And he's still working in that context. And the way in which Gentiles can participate in his blessing is to join into that association. This is what is described in Romans 11 with the analogy of the olive tree, that contrary to nature, wild olive branches could be brought into a cultivated olive tree, that if they choose to believe, they can be brought in that way. I think that this, to say the least, does not form a part of any Christian theology. By definition, it cannot form a part of Christian theology, because Christian theology is not compatible with the idea of Gentiles being brought into a Commonwealth of Israel instead of being brought into the church. A recent comment that my father made, actually, with regard to some issues of Passover at the Seder, is, I think, interesting. Christians, as you know, often talk about grace and God's grace. And the typical presentation that you can hear, obviously not from all Christians, but even from some of the most Israel-supporting and Bible-believing Christians of today, is that the Jews lived under law and the Christians live under grace. The Jews didn't understand God's grace and they were legalistic and so forth. Well, the point my father was making was that actually Christians don't understand God's grace. They actually think that Israel is rejected because of its works. It's bad mm-hmm. works. And that the Christians, are chosen because of their good works, because they believe in the Messiah. Or they believe in Jesus. They don't usually say the Messiah. But so the Christians actually do not understand grace. But what grace is that Israel has been unfaithful, but God is still faithful. God is still gracious towards Israel, and he's shown this all along through all of the prophets and through the Messianic writings as well. And this continues. So sometimes people ask if they're supposed to believe then that God is working through the Jews today, through the Israel of today, just as he worked through the Jews of, 3,000 years ago, or the Israel of David and Solomon and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
The answer is yes, of course, mm-hmm. if you just read the text. What causes people to ask that question, though? One of the reasons, I think, is that they're influenced by the theology, of course. But another reason is that they see that Israel as a whole is not always walking with God. So how could God be working through that nation? How could his promises still be valid for them? They're not his people. But one thing that's not recognized is that if you look at the past history, when Christians do recognize God working through Israel, most of the time, the majority of Israel was not walking with God then either. In fact, if you read the whole history of Israel, there's hardly a time when you could say that all of Israel was walking with God. That's not the issue at all. The issue is God's choice and how he has decided to bring about redemption on the earth.
Also, they don't understand the concept of being grafted in.
Mm-hmm.
They still
right.
don't get the concept of being grafted in. But you always need the tree.
Right.
You always need the stem, because without it, you are not going to exist.
You need the sap. Right. Otherwise, you have no life.
Right.
And the sap is from the tree of Israel that God
right.
has created.
Right.
One of the most profound things I had in my trip to Israel was when we went to the Western Wall. And I have to admit, I kind of was going there with, I think, with it was like a historical thing, you know, because the temple's not there and all that stuff. And the presence of God was so strong. And I thought to myself, and yet, you know, most of these people praying here are not with him. They're not following him. And yet, his relationship with the Jewish people is so strong that even then, you know, it's still strong. And you can imagine, you know, when as a whole, all restored, you know, what that will be.
Right.
So, yeah. It's,
and that's what Romans 11 goes on to say, mm-hmm. that the restoration of Israel will be like life from the dead for the whole world. Mm-hmm. And so, again, this comes back to the whole point of Israel's calling is for the benefit of the Gentiles. The Gentiles have seen it as if it's something that they have to destroy and usurp, as if it makes them second-class citizens. Actually, it's for the benefit of the Gentiles, and to the extent to which the Gentiles impede the calling of Israel, they are impeding their own blessing and their own benefit from God and their own ability to have hope and to have a true relationship with God and with his Messiah and to participate in his covenants. To the extent that Gentiles seek to support God's plan and the calling of Israel, they are enhancing their own blessing and the benefits that come from being part of the Commonwealth of Israel. Now, there's a story about George Washington, if I remember my elementary education. I think he was from the Commonwealth of Virginia, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And supposedly he chopped down a tree once.
A cherry tree,
right. And then he repented.
Didn't he die?
And many authors, of course, say that this is a fictitious story. It never happened, but maybe it did. We don't know. In any event, one of the lessons of tonight, I think, is don't chop down the olive tree.
Mm-hmm.
It will not benefit you. It's worse than chopping down a cherry tree.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with regard to the Commonwealth in particular, which is the topic of this chapter, there was the British claim that the sun never set on its empire. Mm-hmm. Sun never sets on the British Empire. And humans like to make these grandiose claims, and they like to promote, we like to promote our own power and prestige. That's one of our weaknesses as humans. We have an inflated sense of our own worth and our own accomplishments at the same time as we don't understand the fullness of our true worth and the true accomplishments that we can attain. But all of these human empires do fail, and the sun does set now on the British Commonwealth. The British Empire doesn't even exist anymore. And many other empires have come and gone as well, and will come and go. But in the scriptures, as we read, God actually does promise a commonwealth on which the sun will never set. Mm-hmm. And that's the Commonwealth of Israel in Isaiah 60, mm-hmm. that when God arises and his glory is seen upon Israel, that this, your sun will never set again, your moon will wane no more, the Lord will be your everlasting light. God himself is the light of Israel, the sun that will never set, and your days of sorrow will end.